Welcome back to the Better Know a Lawyer podcast. This is Noah Weil, and this is part two of my interview with Justice McLeod. We left off last week talking about preservation of issues and bad lawyer conduct that kind of ties the hands of when the Supreme Court can hear a case. We'll talk about some other stuff too. It's a good topic and a good interview. Again, big thanks to Justice McLeod for taking the time to sit with me, to open up her chambers, to allow me to come in and chat with her. I'm really happy how this all turned out, and I hope you enjoy it too. Stay tuned.
Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
So we talk about preservation of issues, and I think you're right that you're bound as a court of appeals by with the record below you, and if the record's deficient, that ties your hands.
Right.
So how does that work in more detail? How can the record be deficient, or what can you be missing to make a decision?
Well, I'm awful because I did trials and I did appeals, and I read a transcript and I think to myself, Stand up and object. But the bottom line is, if there's no objection to a perceived error or an error that's being raised on appeal, there's just different rules that apply. And unless and until those different rules are completely changed, we abide by them. So one of those rules is that you need to object in the trial court for the appellate court to review the issue. There are exceptions. Do you as a lawyer want to be arguing why, spend your time arguing why you fit within an exception? God, no. You just want to be arguing about the merits of the case. But there's a lot of cases where as you dig through it, you realize that the issue that's being presented in our court for review might not have been identified for the trial judge beforehand. Now, sometimes it doesn't matter because the record is fully developed enough and you can address it, and we have rules that allow us to do so. But a lot of times it really matters.
It's another hurdle, certainly, for the appellant to jump through that this is an exception.
Oh, yeah. It's something else that is far from the merits that you really, as an appellate lawyer,
it's interesting
you don't want to be spending your time on.
It's interesting you say, you know, as a trial lawyer, I know, object, and you're right. Obviously, as a trial lawyer myself, I know standing up there objecting regularly is important. But you also know, tactically, objecting to an issue can bring the jury's attention to it. And you have to weigh that decision, whether to preserve something for appeal or try to give yourself and your client the best chance of winning at the trial level.
You know, a reviewing judge or justice, I think, the failure to object is just glaring. It's glaring because it influences whether we can review it at all. We have special rules that deal with different standards when there's a failure to object. And it sends a message that some judges and justices are going to take as, geez, maybe it wasn't that bad after all, if they really didn't object. And of course, maybe it's combined with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which can put a different spin on it. But
where I'm coming at it is, I think, two angles. The one is that sometimes what reviewing courts attribute to a tactical decision was not. It was just a mistake, and to not assume that it was tactical kind of raised the standard a little bit for ineffective assistance.
Okay, but so I hear you, and you're talking about assumptions that are not necessarily supported by the record, and we should be careful about that.
And the other is that a trial lawyer in the moment may have to make split-second decisions that he or she may feel is better for his client or her client in the moment of trial, but might make an appellate lawyer's job harder. And all I can say is I've heard this before, that trial lawyers are making their decisions that they feel is best at the time, that even if it makes an appellate lawyer's job harder, they feel it'll help them win the trial.
Well, I think there's a lot of justification for that. You know, the trial is the main event. Most cases, whatever happens at trial, the statistics show that status quo of the trial tends to prevail on appeal. So I totally get the notion that you want to make a decision based on what's right for the client at trial. The question is failing to object what's right for the client at trial? Perhaps failing to object or deciding not to object at the moment is fine, but there's always a break.
Do you think that that's the biggest trial lawyer's mistake, is to not object?
I actually feel more competent to talk about mistakes made by criminal defense lawyers. I think failure to preserve issues is a problem. I think failure to do homework is a problem in a lot of cases, and by that I mean interviewing all the witnesses, preparing directs and crosses, and preparing a theory of the case. I think failure to give an opening statement is, I can't think of any justification for that, but we see that in transcripts.
Really?
Reserved, waive,
oh,
yes.
Goodness,
yes. Yes.
I definitely think preparation is a key component to doing well at trial, which kind of leads to the next topic, which is the Supreme Court is responsible for more than just issuing opinions and deciding what cases to take. You've got court rules to issue. You've got lawyer discipline. And I think one of the topics lately has been caseload standards for public defenders. Can you talk a little bit about how that came in front of the Supreme Court? I don't think it was your term that you issued the most recent decision, but can you just talk about the process of those kind of rules and guidance for lawyers?
Well, I wish I could take credit for having developed the caseload standards on the court, but they were actually developed before I was elected in 2012. They were a project a long time in the making that a number of public defenders had been pushing for a long time, and they had been meeting about for a long time. But the caseload standards for misdemeanor representation were adopted by the court based on all of that work within the last, 5 years or so. And then the implementation date was adjusted, and we're getting feedback on it now. But as far as we can tell, they're out there, they're influencing caseloads, they're influencing the number of lawyers that have to be hired, and they are making a positive impact on the quality of lawyering that our poorest citizens get when they're forced into court.
I do a little bit of appointed work, and it's relevant for me. I'm not anywhere near running them to the standards, but I still have to do a certification that I'm, you know, following them. But I actually talked to a public defender friend of mine just a couple of days ago, and he was telling me he's had a huge caseload, huge caseload, huge caseload, and then he ran up against his limit for the month, and he basically didn't have any extra cases assigned to him for the month of July. And what a breath of fresh air it was, that all the good work he could do for his clients because he had that breather and that he could focus on the clients he had rather than having to deal with new ones all the time.
God, that's wonderful feedback. That's feedback that I'd love to see get out there a lot more, so that people understand not just the fact that there's some financial cost involved, but that there's a wonderful benefit involved in providing justice and time and real counsel to people who really need it. I would love to see those stories get out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What logistically is the process of the courts dealing with things like standards and things like court rules, rules of evidence, rules of practice, that kind of thing?
We have committees set up for a variety of the different tasks that we take on. So I sit on the rules committee. I think our committees strive to be five people. Justice Johnson chairs the rules committee. So for rules, they're proposed by somebody. Often it's the bar that's proposing it, but not necessarily. Wachtel has proposed rules. Other organizations have proposed rules. They come before us as a committee, and then they're presented to the nine-member court for a variety of decisions. From the beginning to the end, it would be, should we publish this for comment? Or not even publish it for comment. Once published it for comment, what do we think of the comments? Should we take the action that we initially proposed, or should we adjust it based on the comments that we've gotten? And ultimately, should we adopt the rule or should we adopt the amendment? So a ton of the court's work takes place by committee and by individuals within the committee. And then there's the collective committee group getting together to hash it out, and then the ultimate decision going to the nine members of the en banc court, not at our monthly en banc case meeting, but at our monthly en banc administrative meeting.
I didn't realize that before I became a lawyer, but how much behind-the-scenes work you guys do that's really important. If 404B was ever amended, that would have ripples across every trial in the state, things like that. That's very important. You guys deal with lawyer discipline as well?
We deal with lawyer discipline. That's a different process because that all goes through the bar first. But yes, I agree with you. There's a ton of stuff that goes on behind the scenes. There's individual stuff. There's committee work. There's stuff that goes to the en banc. To me, the interesting thing was that if it's not case-related, we're not acting as, quote, justices, unquote. And so I can talk about rules. I can be lobbied on rules. I can call up people who've submitted comments on rules.
What's your title on those categories? If you're not a justice.
Well, I'm a justice wherever I go. But I can be lobbied.
The opinions are more hermetic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's good reason for that. There's two parties coming in front of the court, and you want to give each of them the most fairness that you can and not open yourself up to being lobbied by something extraneous that's not them and that they don't know about. But on rules, I can do whatever I want. I can talk to whoever I want. And if I had unlimited amounts of time, I might actually do that.
We all would. Yeah. You know, all the time in the world. Is there any other areas where you can either advocate or take input? Any other topics? Do you ever talk about the legislature, about funding courts, about, I know there's a thing of public education that's an actual case right now, but are there other topics or issues that you can go and advocate for with the prestige of your office?
Yeah, not on political matters, but on matters that have to do with the administration and the integrity of the court. So I can certainly speak to bar groups and do CLEs and speak at high schools and speak to the Rotary Club and do all of those things on issues of public interest or to educate them about the courts. We can, let me give you an example. We have a Gender and Justice Commission of the Washington Supreme Court. There's also a Minority and Justice Commission of the Washington Supreme Court. And those entities, although or because they're entities of the court, are limited in certain ways, but speak out and advocate and educate on matters concerning the administration of justice within the realm of those things. So we can certainly speak to the legislature and other branches of government if it impacts the administration of the courts.
Do you have any particular pet issues or interest of the court issues that you care the most about?
Well, I care greatly about the courts retaining their independence and not being being a full and independent branch of the government.
How is it threatened?
Well, I think nationally it's being threatened by rhetoric that we hear on the national stage attacking particular judges because of their ethnicity or their nationality. I think nationally it's being threatened when you hear calls to take somebody off a court because of decisions of his or hers that you don't like. I think it's threatened when in jurisdictions where there's elections that in which judicial candidates seemingly make promises about how they'll vote on certain cases or not. I think it's threatened if there's implicit appeals to racial bias or ethnic bias. And I worry that in 2012, that my colleague, Justice Steve Gonzalez, suffered from implicit appeals by his opponent that enabled the opponent to garner votes despite the fact that the opponent didn't do any campaigning, didn't participate in any of the debates that I was at, and really did almost nothing to show the public what he was about. So I'm really quite concerned by proposals, including proposals that I consider attacks on this court based on some of our decisions. But fortunately, they have not been passed by the legislature. Cooler minds have prevailed. And I hope that's what continues to happen in the future. But I really think that the judiciary alone can't defend the judiciary. It's got to be the people as a whole who stand up and say, no, we want judges who are fair, and we don't want judges influenced beforehand to vote like a legislator or like a governor. We want the judges being fair and upholding constitutional rights.
I had the pleasure of hearing Justice O'Connor speak one time at the law school. And actually, she was vehemently against judicial elections, partially for the reasons you've said. You know, someone like Justice Gonzalez, who won the election, but faced extra heat and challenge simply because of his name and, you know, his race. She was extremely opposed to those events happening. But she said that one of the best ways to promote judicial independence, something she cared about as well, was civics classes and how they've been cut from a lot of public education, and bringing back more funding and more
encouragement for civics. She's right. I just finished reading a book of hers that's sort of a memoir of the court, not just a memoir because it's an historical view of the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm really struck by the things that I now appreciate as her contributions that I really didn't appreciate before. And they are in the area of civics and independence of the judiciary and respect for the judiciary. I think before I ran for the Washington Supreme Court, I would have viewed Justice O'Connor certainly as a trailbreaker, a trailblazer, and an important voice on the court, but really more as a sort of pragmatist. And having just read her book on the workings of the court, I view her now as really insightful, intelligent, trying to blend pragmatism and context with constitutional principles, and trying to do it all in an extremely professional way that called for respect towards the courts rather than engaging in name calling or something else that does not cast respect on the courts.
I don't know if you ever heard her speak in person, but besides the obvious intelligence and wit she has, her presence alone, just the way she can command a crowd, is very impressive. I'm sure she was very fierce behind the closed doors, advocating for the position she thought was best, and it was a pleasure to listen to her.
I bet she was, but I bet that she was polite.
Oh, sure.
The entire time, and I bet that she was respectful, and she called my attention to symbols of collegiality, like the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court justices, based on a tradition introduced over 100 years ago, shake hands, each one with the other, before each argument. So that's a lot of handshakes, but it's a symbol of the fact that they're a court. You can say what you want as an individual, but five votes is what's going to count, and you're working with people with different backgrounds, and you've got to have respect for everything that they bring to the table.
So I want to get into that a little bit, but I remember reading an article maybe a few weeks ago about someone who had practiced a lot in front of the United States Supreme Court, and his thoughts, a 30-year career or something, was just how respectful everybody was. The issues were huge, national importance, death, abortion, etc., but that it just felt like a higher calling, that it was so intellectual and respectful to your opponents. Sometimes you would point out to the other side a case that you thought they should reference and it was relevant for the discussion, just to get to the best possible decision. And I was wondering, since you've done trial work and appellate work, if you feel that the appellate work has been more of a higher calling or a higher intellectual field compared to like the nitty-gritty bare-knuckle stuff of trial work, or is there still that air of adversarialness here?
Well, I'm going to turn the question around, or I'm going to turn the answer around. I think trial work was an incredibly high calling. And even though in the midst of anything that's really important to you, there's going to be fiery outbursts and there's going to be imperfections and stuff, I just really think that with the best trial work, you're being called on to be your best self and put your best foot forward and then go home at night and do your homework and prep for the next day, you know, prep the next exam and the next brief. It's so intense at the trial level. To me, that's one of the hardest things to do, because you're facing all the unpredictable stuff right in the heat of battle, and being able to keep your temper and keep your wits about you and still respect the institution of the court in that situation is an incredibly high calling. So I think you've got the high calling at both levels. I get it that in the appellate courts, and especially at the Supreme Court level, it's often far more soft-spoken and more polite, and we certainly have far more time to research our issues and decide a case. But I think that we can all have the same level of dignity and respect in the heat of battle, and the occasional apology when you lose it, and we all do, to show that, yes, it's extremely important to us, but I recognize it's bigger than just me.
So then we'll turn that around and say, you've had a litigants argue in front of you, the attorneys, about an issue, and it's time to retire to the chambers, whenever that is, after the argument happens. Does it ever get hot in there? Are the justices ever having raised voices or standing up or storming or something, not all the time, but some emotion being injected in this process with such high stakes?
Yes.
How is that handled?
sometimes very well and other times differently. It's, you know, we're just a group of people, like if you're in a joint defense situation or you're on a bar committee or you're on something that is of extreme importance to you and it's of extreme importance to everybody and everybody has a different view on it. So the chief chairs our meetings. We try to be respectful of each other and of the chief in calling on people.
Is there a talking stick? Do you have to pass the stick around before you're allowed?
There's not a talking stick, but there is a protocol and there's rules. So we close the door behind us after a fierce argument on some issue in public, you know, after the lawyers have argued. We close the door, we go into the room, and the justice who did the pre-hearing on the case will report on the case. And that justice will stand up and we will all listen. And typically, we're actually dressed for the occasion. We're dressed more formally when we're meeting for the court after we take off our robes. There'll be a formal presentation, and the presentation will have a recommended outcome. And then the chief will ask if there's questions. And there may be heated questions about the case that the reporting justice will answer, and maybe somebody else will chime in to answer to. And then the chief will argue, will ask, is there a contrary view? And somebody might state a dissenting view or a concurring view or something. Mm-hmm. And then following the discussion, we vote. So the reporting justice has voted first. We're seated in a particular order around the table based on seniority, which I can't show to you easily on a podcast. But it's the same seating arrangement until the composition of the court changes. And after the reporting justice votes, the justice to his or her right will then vote, and so on as we go around in a circle. And upon voting, we'll speak his or her piece, and additional discussion might ensue, and the chief might once again be called upon to direct that discussion more fruitfully.
So it's kind of a straw poll initially?
No, that's the vote.
Oh, okay.
And the chief will assign opinion, dissent, concurrence based on the vote.
I assume there's a lot of communication beforehand, right?
Well, there's...
The clerks are talking and sharing.
Right, and there's a pre-hearing that was circulated beforehand, which typically contains a recommendation, so you know at least how one justice is planning to vote and encourage others to vote, and then there's talking among the justices as well. So you know that beforehand, and then your discussion can be lengthy or not as lengthy, heated or not as heated, clear or not as clear. You know, it's, some days are better than others. We always strive to be at our best, and sometimes we make it. But then you vote, and that's at the conclusion of a half hour of discussion, 2 hours of discussion, 5 hours of discussion, whatever it takes, and the opinions are assigned. Well then, it's time for lunch. And we take turns bringing lunch and sharing it with all nine justices so that everybody doesn't have to bring a little bag lunch. So my thing is that my husband really loves to cook, and I'll typically bring a home-cooked spread that he's done. Some other justice's thing might be to order out Thai food. Another justice's thing might be that they enjoy cooking themselves. And then we'll sit down and eat for a few minutes and not talk about the cases while we're eating, so that we have a way to reconnect and a way to remember that we're a court and not just individuals again. And then, you know what? We go on to the next case.
Throw down your forks. All right, let's do this again. Roll up sleeves. Do you guys socialize outside of business hours?
From time to time. Sometimes we do at other events, at bar events, if we're together. Sometimes we'll have a lunch together. The chief used to try to do that once a term, that we would at least get together over lunch. It's a little difficult to do it in the evenings because we live in so many different places. Many justices have had to move to Olympia because that's where the court sits. I haven't, so I have quite a commute. But
what town are you living in?
Well, I live in Kitsap County. I do have a little mother-in-law apartment down here in Olympia, so I can stay over. And probably more important than that, I have a gym down here in Olympia, so I can get back to normal after a full day.
Do you ever get recognized on the street in down Olympia or in Kitsap?
In both of those places I do, and in Seattle I do, probably in other places less than that. But I practiced in Seattle for 25 years, so I know so many people there. I live in Kitsap County, and my kids went to school in Kitsap County, and my husband is a paraeducator at the high school working with special needs kids at Bainbridge Island High School. So through all of those connections, obviously I know people in my own neighborhood.
That's nice, yeah. Right?
Yes and no. It's, you know, you can't always wear the same cut-up jeans that you might otherwise wear.
See, this is why I wouldn't make a good politician, because it's like comfortable clothes. I don't care who's my voters.
You know. Oh, look, I'm going to tell your listeners that you are wearing a shirt and tie for me.
I'm in the Supreme Court of Washington State. You're in this beautiful building. There's
I appreciate the respect grounds, that you brought to the court.
The grounds of our state legislature and everything else. Yeah. I mean, I know as the least senior justice, you have the worst chambers here, and it's disappointing we're in a broom closet right now. But, you know, after the election, you'll be able to advance and to get a full room with
doors. I just want to point out that I am not the least senior justice. Justice Yu, who was appointed after I was elected, is the least senior justice. And when she came on the court, she took my seat at the conference table, and I moved up one, and then Justice Gonzalez moved up one, and then Justice Wiggins moved up one, et cetera, et cetera.
So when do you get to get new chambers if you want them?
I think if and when a new justice comes onto the court is when chambers usually change. But
you like your place?
You know, Justice Chambers, whose seat I took, vacated chambers and others moved around so that this was the only chambers left over because they all wanted a view. I got this chambers because it's considered not having a view. But I'm actually looking at the steps of the ledge building, and I get to see every demonstration, pro or con, any issue that comes to the court. All the lobbyists, all the school classes, all the press interviews when the legislators come out and give an interview on the steps. So I actually think that I've got the best seat in the House.
Do you ever, if there's a protest of a cause you don't agree with, do you ever throw water balloons from your office and then just, you know, hide behind the wall really quick?
What did we used to say? You have a right to remain silent.
I feel like there's a danger of, because you're dealing with issues that are so heavy, literally life and death, there's a danger of emotion and running away. Not with the opinions necessarily, but just the personalities, because you're elected officials and you're dealing with such strong issues and you're obviously all very intelligent. And it's comforting to know that you guys can move on from any hot issue and, you know, do the job that the people want you to do.
We always do. Sometimes it's harder than others, but we always move on.
Is it frustrating to be part of a 9-person panel that you might have strong opinions on something, but you're only one ninth of it?
Well, it's certainly less frustrating than being the attorney arguing and not being one of the 9.
Yeah.
Look, it's got some frustrations and it's got some rewards. The reward is that you're at the table, you've looked into the issue as well as you and your clerks can look into it, but eight other people have as well, and they've got a different background than me. So they might say, well, yes, Justice, I agree, but I sat on the trial court, and I've got to tell you how this would play out on the trial court. Or let me tell you my perspective from having been at the Attorney General's office and how this would play out in that realm. Or let me tell you my perspective from the personal injury side of things. And they've thought things through in a way that I didn't have the background to realize I should think them through. So there's this benefit of, you know, two heads are better than one. What's the detriment? It takes five votes, and sometimes I'm not in the majority. But on balance, I think the people are getting the benefit of a lot of different views and a lot of different backgrounds.
You said in the beginning that when you were a practicing lawyer, and maybe even before then, you would look at situations, civil rights issues, and so on, and say, that's not fair. And I think I understand exactly where you're coming from. You know, I've also done public defense, and I understand those feelings. And you've also said that of the nine justices, you're the only one with that kind of background. I think it's safe to say that a lot of the opinions you've authored, either majority opinions or dissents, have a, I wouldn't say pro-criminal defendant, but more of a nuanced view of the issues in criminal defense and criminal justice. How do you feel about being kind of the sole voice of those issues? And oftentimes you're writing a dissent that the other justices didn't agree with your nuanced view.
I think I'm the person with the greatest background in criminal defense work and criminal defense appeals. But there's other justices on the court who, from time to time before they were on the court, did take criminal cases and did take appointed cases, Chief Justice Madsen, Justice Johnson, although they were, at this point, they're quite a bit further away from it than I am. I'm thrilled that I can bring to the court not what I consider a criminal defense point of view, but what I consider a constitutional rights point of view. But I'm also thrilled that I'm not the only one who's bringing it to the court. And although I'm sometimes a sole dissenter, that's rare. And there's other people whose terrific opinions on constitutional rights I've joined. What I think I do bring to the court is an emphasis on how the constitutional rights affect each individual. And I'm really proud that I'm able to speak up for the rights of the individual and to say from time to time, along with other justices who say from time to time, well, now wait, that's not fair. Is that really what the law and what the Constitution says? I think I'm on a court where there's nine justices who care about constitutional rights, but we see them differently in some cases.
I would say, just my personal experience, and I haven't not been practicing, I mean, nearly as long as you, that your term on the bench, it's been a little bit of a sea change as far as the content in the opinions. I think that more focus on the individual and the day-to-day life of people walking on the street and their interactions with the criminal justice system. And I'm, you know, again, as someone with the same background, I really appreciate that. And do you think that that's part of your legacy, that the justices are starting to look at things from that more individual point of view rather than the ivory tower intellectual perspective?
Well, I would love it if that were part of my legacy. But I do want to give credit where credit is due. We have other new voices on the court right around the time that I came on the court, Justice Yu and Justice Gonzalez. And although they don't have a criminal defense background, they have a trial court background, and they're both persons of color, and they bring a particular perspective to the court that had for a long time been absent from it. And I think they're also focused on how constitutional rights and liberties affect individuals in particular situations and in particular neighborhoods and in particular contexts that might otherwise be overlooked. And I also want to credit other colleagues on the court who are on the Minority and Justice Commission and on the Gender and Justice Commission, and who do stop and pause and say, is this the right perspective? What will this rule of law do? How will it work out on the street? That's not something that I'm the only one who can lay claim to.
Can we give you a little credit?
Please.
All right, Justice McLeod, that is all the questions I have. We talked for a good long time, and I think I do have one more question, actually. What if people want to know more about the Washington Supreme Court? If they want to observe arguments or they want to know more about the processes, where can they go for resources?
Great question. They can come right down here. Courtrooms in the state of Washington are open to the public to be viewed and at all times. Our arguments are open to the public. And since we know that we're in Olympia, not everybody gets a chance to come here, all our arguments are also televised on TVW, and you can access them on tvw.org. And the old arguments are archived, so you can look up whatever you want to look up from the past. And the court's website, courts.wa.gov, is a source of additional information on the different levels of the courts, the different people on the courts. But you're welcome to come down to this court, or to go to your local court, your local municipal court or superior court, and just be a court watcher. Just watch what's going on in the courts.
Great. Well, Justice McLeod, that's all the questions I have today.
Thank you so much for coming all the way down to Olympia.
I'm glad this recorded. I'm glad I'm doing it again, but it was a pleasure talking with you and hearing your thoughts on this important thing with your important job.
Thanks.
So, thank you. This is Noah Weil, signing off.